This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with investigative reporter Trevor Aronson about his recent article, The Informants, in Mother Jones magazine.
The article asks, who are the bad guys? Those who are accused of the crimes, or the informants who set them up?
Fear, Inc., the roots of the Islamophobia network in America, is the title of a recent and extraordinary report from the Center for American Progress.
Today we interview Wajahat Ali, one of the authors of Fear, Inc. Did Islamophobia just fall out of the sky, or was it part and parcel of a well-funded network run in the United States, made up of foundations, groups, and individuals who are out to demonize Muslims?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. In past shows, we have discussed the number of cases that the FBI has brought against Muslim defendants. Muslim defendants that were often, if not always, set up by the FBI to commit, quote, crimes. In an important new article called The Informants, just published in Mother Jones, Trevor Aronson outlines what is going on in these prosecutions and in scores of others around the country. He points out that since 9/11, the FBI now spends more than $3 billion a year on counterterrorism. It maintains a team of 15,000 spies in a nationwide network of informants. Many of these informants are tasked with infiltrating Muslim communities in the United States. As investigative reporter Trevor Aronson points out of 508 defendants in federal terrorism cases, almost 50% were targeted because of informants. The FBI has built a massive network of spies to, quote, prevent another domestic attack. Aronson asks, are they busting terrorist plots or leading them?
Welcome, Trevor Aronson, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
I wanted to start by asking you if you could outline, I think it's about five general findings from your investigation.
The primary finding was the size of the informant network today. So today there are 15,000 informants working for the FBI. And to give that some historical context, there were 1,500 in the mid-70s after the counterintelligence programs that everyone often associates informants and the FBI with. So that's a tenfold increase over just 35 years. The primary reason was that in 2004, President George W. Bush mandated the FBI increase its confidential human sources, the term it uses for informants.
You also say that there are hip pockets. Tell our audience what a hip pocket is.
That's right. So in addition to 15,000 registered informants, which means that the person is vetted, they have an informant ID, there are as many as 45,000 hip pockets. And a hip pocket is someone who isn't on the FBI's books. It's someone who works kind of on an off-the-record basis with the FBI agent. It could be a store clerk who says, you should go check out this guy, or I heard so-and-so saying this. And it's never information that can be used in court or in any sort of criminal affidavit, but it's what the FBI can use to build information and get tips. And it's all part of the FBI's larger effort to create a network of people who provide information that could alert the FBI to potential terrorist threats.
Now, I understand that nearly half of the prosecutions, terrorism-related prosecutions, have involved the use of informants. And you talk about the different incentives, with money being, I guess, one of the largest.
Yeah, money is among the incentives. And most, if not all, informants working for the FBI have some sort of incentive. And for those working for money, they can make a substantial amount of money. In the case of the Newburgh Four outside New York City, the informant, Shahed Hussein, earned $100,000 for his role in that case. But informants also work for the FBI, particularly informants working in counterterrorism, do so for reasons other than money. What the FBI has been particularly effective at is using immigration as a form of leverage to say, to find people who have an immigration violation or are trying to get family over from overseas and use that as leverage to say, well, if you work with us as an informant, we can make this immigration violation go away. or we can help you get your family over from Lebanon, for example.
Now, Trevor, we talk about informants, but you know, it's one thing to be an informant and go in a group and hear, you know, we're going to go do some bombing, and then the informant reports to the FBI. That's one use, but that's not really the use you're focused on in this article. What you're focused on in this article is taking people who might be a little disaffected with America, or not disaffected at all, who might be young, who might have other issues. I guess in the words of lawyers, get them entrapped into much larger plots, or plots at all, that they would ever be involved in. We've covered a number of those on the show, the Newburgh Four, and you cover these in your article. You mentioned the Newburgh Four, you mentioned the Washington Metro bombing plot, the New York subway plot, the Sears Tower, Portland Christmas case, because that's really, I think, the focus of the piece and where it really begins to wonder who's committing the crimes here.
That's right. So in the 500 cases we looked at, 500 defendants, I should say, 49 involved what we considered an agent provocateur, which was an informant who provided the opportunity and or the means to move forward with a terrorist plot. We were able to identify by name 13 informants who were these kind of high-level operators who moved from case to case, in some cases state to state, and worked these cases. And as an example, there was a case in Illinois involving a man named Derek Sharif, and the FBI had come to on the FBI's radar, and the FBI decided to take one of its operators and offer an opportunity for Derek to commit some sort of act of terrorism. At the time, Derek was broke, his car had broken down, and he was working at a video game store, and it was just before Ramadan, and an informant came to him and offered him a place to live and use of his car, and Derek at the time believed that this was God's work because it was just before Ramadan and he needed a place to stay. And so over the course of weeks, these two men become very friendly, and they start to talk about Derek's interest in committing some sort of act of terrorism, and the informant then introduces Derek to an arms dealer. Of course, the arms dealer is an undercover FBI agent. This FBI agent offers Derek grenades so that he can carry out what he wants to do, which is an attack on a shopping mall. Of course, as I mentioned, Derek didn't have any money, so he didn't have any money to buy the grenades, and the FBI agent in turn agreed to allow Derek to give him these old stereo speakers that he had in exchange for grenades that he could use to attack a shopping mall. And this was enough for the government to prove a terrorism conspiracy against Derek Sharif. And he was prosecuted and convicted and sentenced to 35 years in prison. A case like that raises questions of whether someone like Derek Sharif could have committed the crime he was convicted for were it not for the FBI agent and were it not for the FBI informant providing him with the means and opportunity to commit that crime.
But of course, all of these cases, or many of the cases, they have good lawyers. They try and think about raising entrapment defenses in court, which would allow a jury to acquit them. But of course, many of them plead guilty because they know the conviction rate, once the word terrorism is stuck in there, is extremely high. Jurors don't really listen very well to the entrapment defense. So that's another statistic you bring out, I guess, how many of these cases actually plead guilty.
That's right. 8 out of 10 that we found in the 500 or so defendants pleaded guilty. And what's interesting about that is that, A, it shows how difficult it is to, you know, defend against the terrorism charge. And the other is that it makes my job and people who research these cases even harder because a lot of the evidence never comes out. So when someone pleads guilty, a lot of the information about the behavior of the informant and the actions of the FBI never sees the light of day. And so there are real questions about whether there are other cases that we weren't able to identify where the informant was as aggressive as he was in these other cases or even more aggressive because they ultimately pleaded guilty. What defendants are finding is that not only is it very difficult to win in a defense against terrorism, but you know, if you are convicted because of statutory minimums, you're facing a long time in prison. And in many cases, these men, such as in the Newburgh Four and others who've defended at trial, like the Fort Dix case, you know, they receive statutory minimums of 35 years in prison. You know, when you're a young man, 20s, 30s, you know, that's the better part of your life.
Trevor, I'd like to take a step back and ask you how the FBI builds its informant network. Can you tell us what domain management is, the program?
So domain management was initially a program that took crime data and looked for trends. And in 2004, the FBI hired a man from the CIA named Phil Mudd to help it transition to more of an intelligence gathering organization. Phil Mudd took domain management and made a number of changes to it and basically began to incorporate commercially available data, as well as some government data, such as immigration. So it started to allow the FBI to create demographic maps of specific cities. Officially, the FBI says that this domain management program allows it to allocate resources according to threats. But FBI agents I talk to who investigate counterterrorism tell me that, obviously, the FBI believes that the primary threat of counterterrorism comes from within U.S. Muslim communities. So in doing their job, they're going to look at domain management and ask themselves and ask domain management, you know, where do Muslims live in my city? And then from there, they can allocate case agents who can then try to recruit informants from within those areas. And that's exactly how the FBI is able to allocate resources according to counterterrorism. If they're able to use domain management, find where Muslims live, and then place agents and informants in those communities.
Now, this is really focused, domain management, on ethnicity or religion. Is that right?
That's right. It also includes crime data. So, I mean, it's not just counterterrorism. I mean, it's one of its primary uses is counterterrorism. But one thing it can look for example, is a Medicaid fraud or Medicare fraud. And if there's a bunch of Medicare cases and claims in an area where there aren't elderly people, then that's a flag for the FBI that there might be some Medicare fraud going on in that area. So that's one example of what you might consider kind of a legitimate use of demographic data to figure out if crimes are going on. But then they're also used in other ways, just as I mentioned, that it's used to tell them, you know, hey, basically, where's the largest concentration of Muslims in this city? And then they're able to, you know, allocate resources accordingly.
I thought it was really interesting. In one of your findings was that in many sting operations, important encounters between informant and the target were actually not recorded, even though, as you mentioned in your article, technology now makes wiretaps and recordings much easier to do.
Yeah, one of the things that's important to remember when you think of like wires is that I think when people imagine a wire, they think of the pop culture, someone wearing a wire on a TV show, and it's this big black box that's strapped to the belt and a wire across the chest and something very obtrusive and, you know, that could be seen. But in truth, the technology that the FBI uses today for wires are small transmitters that look like a key fob that no one would ever suspect are actually devices that allow for the recording of conversations. Despite this, however, what we found in our investigation was that so many of the sting cases we looked at did not have recordings. One of the primary problems was that early encounters are never recorded. So, for example, in the Newburgh case, Shahed Hussein finally, after a year of trolling through the mosque in Newburgh, meets James Cromedy, and over a course of 4 months, builds a friendship with him. But that entire four-month period was not recorded by the FBI intentionally. You know, they just chose not to record that. What defense attorneys say is, in cases like that, that early period is critical to proving entrapment, that if there were inducements or how the relationship was built, they need to know that through the recordings, and they're never given that opportunity because the recordings don't exist. In other cases, recordings don't exist because of what the FBI considers recording malfunctions or calls recording malfunctions. And among the best examples of that is a case in Baltimore involving a man named Antonio Martinez. And Antonio was a 19-year-old convert to Islam and was interested in bombing a military recruiting station outside Baltimore. And an informant was kind of goading him along and introduced him to an arms dealer who was going to provide him with the explosives to carry out the attack. And just around that time, the FBI announced the arrest in the Portland Christmas tree bombing, which was another sting operation that was going on across the country in Oregon. Well, Antonio Martinez heard about this case on the news and wised up and suddenly realized that he too might be in a sting operation and calls his informant and confronts him and seems to suggest that he wants to back out of the plot. And the informant then sets up a meeting with Antonio to talk about it. And that meeting was not recorded, according to the FBI, because of a recording malfunction. But whatever was said, Antonio got back into the plot and moved forward and ultimately, you know, did try to blow up a van he believed had explosives in it outside a military recruiting station. I think that's a great example of a meeting that really needs to be recorded, because obviously that was perhaps the most critical meeting of that case, where the target of the sting operation was ready to back out and the informant was able to bring him back in. I mean, what was said is you know, the big question, whether inducements did he use other measures, blackmail perhaps, to bring him back? But, you know, we don't know. But whatever it was, you know, certainly the defense attorney, you know, could have used that or could use that in his defense.
We're speaking with Trevor Aronson, the author of an important article in Mother Jones, investigative reporting piece called The Informants, a subtitle, "The FBI has built a massive network of spies to prevent another domestic attack. But are they busting terrorist plots or leading them?"
What are your conclusions about the sort of people that the FBI zero in on to become informants?
It really could run the gamut for informants, but specifically for the higher level operators, like the ones, the Shahed Husseins or Eli Assads, the ones who are carrying forward with these sting operations. One thing we did find is that they usually have checkered pasts. You know, for example, Shahed Hussein had committed fraud in New York before becoming an FBI informant, and there are questions of whether he was lying to the bankruptcy court while he was an informant. In the case of Eli Assad, who worked the Liberty City 7 case in Miami, he had a history of lying, failed a polygraph test, and was accused of beating up his pregnant girlfriend. You know, these are not people who are particularly credible or what you might even consider particularly nice people. You know, they're actually, to do what they do is incredibly difficult. To go into a community, build relationships, all for the purpose of ultimately betraying those relationships, is not something I think most people can do. So it takes a certain person, someone perhaps who has whose behavior is somewhat even sociopathic. These informants all kind of meet that profile where they tend to have a checkered past, but have this ability to get people to know them and to like them and quickly and without much remorse turn on them using those relationships.
And what kind of people do they target? Would you define them as what, losers?
Yeah, there's actually like a very specific profile, with some exceptions, but enough similarities that I think we can describe it as a profile. And that is that they tend to be economically desperate, if not poor. In many cases, they're converts to Islam, and they have such an elementary understanding of the religion that the informant is able to use that against them. You know, to say, for example, that the Quran, there's something in the Quran that in fact isn't there. And as far as their economic situation, the informant is also able to use that against them. And in the Neuberg case, for example, he was consistently offering money. In the Liberty City case, they were consistently offering money. And so these aren't people who are well off, or they're not people who are necessarily committed or that religiously devout. In many cases, as I said, they're poor with very crude understandings of the religion.
Trevor, this study was conducted along with the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley. Can you tell us a bit about the study's parameters?
The investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley is a separate nonprofit affiliated with the university's journalism school, and it funds long-term investigations that are then published through media partners such as Mother Jones or in other projects we've done, Frontline or the New York Times. What we tried to do in this investigation that I think was different from other reporting on this topic was to try to get away as much as possible from anecdotal evidence. When we looked at other research on this topic, it tended to weave together a couple of examples and then come to a conclusion using those anecdotes. What we tried to do instead was build a database, build data that we could draw conclusions from. And so the lion's share of our work included compiling 500 cases that met the DOJ's definition of a terrorism case, and then painstakingly go through the court documents to identify whether an informant was involved in that case, and then the role that the informant played, whether he played a role that we could consider an agent provocateur. And then as we were doing that, we worked very hard to gain cooperation from FBI agents, current and former, who could explain to us the behind-the-scenes and policy implications of what the data was showing us, you know, what was going on in these sting operations that we were then in turn reading about and putting into our database.
And how difficult was it to get the trust and cooperation of FBI agents?
It took a long time. I mean, obviously, the FBI is a rather media-shy organization and isn't necessarily the most reflective or interested in being reflective with a journalist. But we were actually very successful. I mean, we were able to get cooperation from the people who helped build the network, who, you know, were the ones responsible for shaping the FBI's counterterrorism policies for what they are today. And I think we worked really hard to explain what the FBI's view in this is. And I think that's an important side of it, to understand that, you know, because the FBI believes its number one priority is to prevent the next attack, it also believes its main priority is then to find and identify the people who are most willing to commit these acts and use the only mechanism it has to get them off the street, which is criminal prosecution. And when I had asked the FBI agents, you know, when I asked them about some of these cases that we've talked about now, that seem very questionable, what they say, and I think most people can empathize with it, is you know, what would you have us do? That this person says he wants to, you know, commit an act of violence, go blow up a shopping mall. Would you just ignore him and let him go and hope he matures? Or do you do what we do, which is to put together a sting operation and get him off the street? Because no FBI agent wants to be the guy who gets a lead on someone who says he wants to commit some kind of terrorist act and says, yeah, he'll mature out of it. He's just mouthing off. And then finds out 6 months later that, in fact, the person dropped grenades in a shopping mall. So I think that's the real conflict.
What's your answer?
I don't know. I think that's what makes this so difficult. And I think that's what makes talking about these cases very important, why it makes you talking about these cases very important, because I think the real question is, you know, how can the FBI identify people who are threats, someone like Najib Al-Azazi, without bringing in people who evidence suggests have no capacity to commit these crimes, such as James Cromedy. I think at this point the FBI has gone a little too far the other way, where they're bringing in people who do not have the capacity to commit these crimes for fear that they're going to miss someone who does have the capacity. I think what the FBI maybe should do in looking at these cases is try to figure out how many of these cases were actual threats and how can they learn from that in the future to maybe more precisely target people who are actual threats to people or structures of some sort.
Trevor, a few weeks ago we interviewed Katie Galloway, one of the producers of the film Better This World. The subject matter overlaps a bit with FBI agent interviews being very instructive on the issue you've just mentioned.
Right, yes, I'm familiar with Katie's work. Her work also was a product of the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley. A very similar circumstance where an informant was used to almost to lead a plot involving the two men that were ultimately charged with the crime in Minnesota. And I think it's important to realize, too, that this is not exclusive to the Muslim community. The FBI has used sting operations in other ways, and that's one example. What we're seeing it most predominantly in Muslim communities, because that's where the FBI believes the number one threat for terrorism comes from. But they are using these sting operations in other ways. And in that case, too, there were certainly credibility questions about the informant, Brandon Darby, just as there were credibility questions about the informants in many of the cases I looked at.
Trevor, the figure that you quote, $3.3 billion in the FBI budget to do this sort of thing, then you contrast that with the $2.6 billion for organized crime. Talk to us about that.
Right. So before 9/11, the FBI's primary mission was as an investigative organization. You know, it went after criminal enterprises, whether that criminal enterprise was a traditional organized crime like the Italian mafia, for example, or what you might consider white-collar crime, such as a Bernie Madoff running a Ponzi scheme. But since 9/11, the FBI switched and became as much an intelligence-gathering organization as a crime-investigating organization. And so the budget reflects that today. So the lion's share of the FBI's total budget today is in counterterrorism. And then by counterterrorism, it means preventing crimes, you know, preventing the next attack. And so as much, if not more, resources today from the FBI are devoted to gathering intelligence and gathering information about crimes that might happen, that could happen, instead of waiting for crimes that did happen and then going in and investigating what exactly happened and putting together charges against the people involved.
Trevor, did your research reveal the extent to which corporations are involved in the use of informants and surveillance?
I didn't. We didn't come across any cases where informants were used. I mean, there are some contractors involved with the software. There's a software program that they use to track informants that I think they did have a vendor for, but I don't. That really wasn't a big part of our investigation.
I want to go back for a second. When we talk about people who, you know, the FBI is going after and setting up sting operations, and they've gone too far in that direction, partly because they fear that it, on their watch they don't want to have someone commit a crime, you know, that you need a criminal predicate to be able to start an investigation of someone. So I look at your article in the Domain program and putting all these people, thousands of agents all over the place and informants and tracking people is really illegal under what I would have thought were the criminal guidelines from pre-Bush at this point, from before 9/11, when there was a criminal predicate required for at least a preliminary investigation. There's no longer that. It's basically you don't need anything. An FBI agent can go into a mosque without any idea that a crime might be committed. So I start from that as one point as being way too far. And then as the next point, that even if someone says an expression, I want to do something, or I'm thinking about doing something, unless that person makes some movement toward that and doesn't overt act toward it, I find it objectionable to, even if you think that person might be a bad person, to then set them up as a sting, as a means of bringing them out. Because as you said, you're bringing in perhaps scores of innocent people. So I guess I don't buy into what the FBI is saying at all about this. And I'm not, you know, can respond a little bit, but I just think that, that we've gone much too far, not just a little too far on it.
Yeah, on the issue of predicate, there has been significant changes just within the last decade since 9/11. And the most significant is what the FBI calls an assessment. And what that allows for is the FBI can open an investigation with case agent approval on anyone for a 72-hour period without a criminal predicate. So they could investigate you, they could investigate anyone if they had any reason to believe something might be up with something. You know, they don't have enough to meet the bar of criminal predicate, but they have enough to meet their own suspicion. And so that for 72 hours, the FBI guidelines allow them to look into you, to look into your records, to follow you around, to figure out if there might be a criminal predicate. And from that, after that 72-hour period, they try to establish the predicate based on that assessment, you know, based on information they're able to gather. So that has been a significant change, whereas before they couldn't look into your records, they couldn't surveil you unless they already had that specific criminal predicate. And as far as, you know, what you're saying about the FBI providing the means, you know, what the FBI says is that they are getting people off the streets through these sting operations that would commit an act of terror worth an Al-Qaeda operative or someone else to provide them with the means to do that, to someone else here in the United States to actually say, hey, here's the bomb that you can place at the shopping mall. The question that's raised, though, in my opinion, is has there ever been anyone actually in the United States, an Al-Qaeda operative or someone else, who actually did try to provide that weaponry to a so-called lone wolf? And what we found is that I have no evidence of that. There hasn't been any cases that we can find where some of that threat actually became a reality. You know, there is the case of Najib Al-Azazi, who was trained in Pakistan and came dangerously close to bombing the New York City subway system. But in that case, he was someone who was his own operator. He went and got training and was putting together a bomb using common chemicals that you use in beauty salons. But there hasn't been a case where someone like an Antonio Martinez in Baltimore, some 19-year-old kid with no capacity, just a will to commit some kind of act of violence, was then confronted by someone who could actually provide him with that means. What we found in our investigation was that all these people were always confronted by FBI informants who provided the means. And so while they had an interest in committing these crimes, their capacity was only made available by the FBI, which raises significant questions about whether they could have actually committed this crime were it not for the FBI informant being there to provide that means.
But it's, you know, it's had a tremendous effect, I think, on the public mindset. I remember when President Nixon left office and he was interviewed, and the reporter asked him what his secret was to his success as a politician. Without missing a beat, Nixon said it was fear. I used fear. And they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts. And my own observation after reading your excellent article, Trevor, is that the accomplishment of this $3.3 billion annual effort to get these informants to set people up is that they've used fear to change the mindset of the American people. I want to know what your response is to that.
I think to a certain extent that's true. I mean, what's ended up happening is that for every terrorism case they're able to announce, and when these sting operations are over and an arrest is made, there's always a very dramatic press conference that makes the news in your community and makes the local front page, and there's a mugshot of the guy looking pretty scary, and it's always about a scary plot of a bombing a subway system or bombing a building of some sort. And I think what that does is further engender in people this idea that there is a very dangerous threat from within the Muslim community, that Muslims terrorists are very dangerous and they're very real, and at any time they could strike. When in fact that isn't the case, you know, when in fact that most of the actual terrorism plots that we examined and we looked at were actually sting operations that was totally under the FBI's control, so that no one was ever at any danger. But when these cases are announced, I think people are very scared by them, and I think that further kind of helps shape public policy toward continuing these efforts, toward continuing a very vigilant approach to counterterrorism, particularly within the Muslim community. I would go as far as saying that I don't even think the FBI would necessarily deny this. I think when you ask the FBI about the purposes of their sting policies or the purposes of their sting operations, it's as much to get someone off the street who is interested in committing an act of terror as it is to create a hostile environment for potential terrorists. So the idea is that not only are you getting off this person off the street, but the guy you missed who might be interested in committing an act of terrorism, he's going to be that less likely to want to do it because he'll be looking over his shoulder thinking, well, is that guy an informant? Is this guy an informant? And you create this hostile environment for terrorism. You engender this fear among the potential terrorists. But the problem, too, obviously, is that you create fear in the community of people that aren't terrorists either.
Trevor, so well put, and we'd all like to commend you on a really important piece of investigative journalism that adds to the continuing body of work that we're all trying to put together. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Trevor.
Really critical piece.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
As many suspected, the attacks on September 11, 2001 didn't drive anti-Muslim sentiment by itself. There was some help, a lot of help. In a shocking new report, seven foundations have been part of a 10-year campaign to spread Islamophobia in the United States. The 130-page report by the Center for American Progress titled Fear, Inc., The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America, names the foundations and key individuals who have promoted Islamophobia from 2001 to 2009. These funds went to think tanks and grassroots organizations to spread messages of hate and fear as far as they could. The Donor Capital Fund was the single biggest contributor, donated $18 million out of the $42 million in the 8-year span. We're joined today by San Francisco attorney Wajahat Ali to talk more about the report. Wajahat is a researcher for the Center for American Progress. Wajahat Ali, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're a practicing attorney in San Francisco. You were one of a group of people that did this marvelous report on the genesis of Islamophobia in the United States. I'm going to throw out a couple of talking points to you and ask you where these talking points came from. President Obama is a Muslim. Sharia is a threat to America. Mosques are Trojan horses. Radical Islam has infiltrated America, the government and mainstream Muslim organizations. There's no such thing as a moderate Islam. Traditional Islam is radical Islam. Practicing Muslims cannot be loyal Americans, and so forth. Where did all this fear-inducing stuff come from?
So this is an investigative report. It took 6 months, and it's really an expose on how seven funders have given $43 million over 10 years to a small, interconnected group of individuals and organizations responsible for mainstreaming fear, bigotry, and hate against Muslims and Islam in America. And specifically, what we do for the first time is really dissect and expose this network, categorize it, name the names, connect the dots, and trace the funding, and about $42.6 million back to the funders, and show the genesis of exactly those talking points that were once fringe and now are mainstream. Specifically, The network is broken into five categories. The first one is the money trail, which are the seven funders. The second one...
Wajahat, a little bit slower. The first one is the...
Yeah, the first one is what we call the money trail, the funders. There are seven funders. We traced around $42.6 million in the past 10 years that they've given primarily to the next group, which what I call is the Islamophobia Scholars and Experts, which is the nerve center, the central nervous system of the Islamophobia Network, a group of about five individuals and organizations that are primarily responsible for creating the manufactured talking points that you that were just heard. These five scholars and experts are Frank Gaffney and the Center for Security Policy, Daniel Pipes and his think tank Middle East Forum, David Yerushalmi and his think tank Society of Americans for National Existence. We also have Steve Emerson of the Investigative Project on Terrorism. And finally, Robert Spencer, the co-founder of the hate group Stop Islamization of America and director of the blog Jihad Watch.
You know, in the old days, in order to divide and conquer, there was a whole wave of anti-communist hysteria. One of the guys that participated that was Daniel Pipes. And here he is trading in hats, capitalizing on creating another wave of hysteria. And this one's against Muslims.
And you know your history. You know, a lot of people ask us, you know, what are the motivations behind these individuals? And what the report shows is, as far as the funders goes, you know, we really don't know the motivations behind the funders, so we didn't really mention it, because some of them, it very well could be, were misled by these individuals in the network who actually, by the way, are very successful by posing as quote-unquote legitimate experts and scholars on Islam and Muslims, and also they kind of push an anti-Muslim agenda under the guise of doing research on national security and terrorism. Some of these people are different. For example, Frank Gaffney, like I mentioned, the five of the central nervous system, the Islamophobia scholars and experts, he comes exactly from this type of Cold War mentality. Used to work for the Reagan administration, and in the 80s and 90s, you know, his boogeyman threat was, you know, the Soviet Union. That boogeyman, of course, now has been replaced by what I call as a lucrative cash cow, Muslim as the boogeyman. Some of the other individuals, for example, like Rush Limbaugh from the hate radio section, that's the media megaphone part of the network, I believe they're just in it for the money. I think he'll say what he has to say just because it's lucrative. And then finally, there's others like Bridget Gabriel and Pamela Geller, who both respectively run what I call anti-Muslim grassroots organizations, Act for America and Stop Islamization of America. I believe they have a deep-seated animosity towards Muslims.
Yeah, well, we've seen Pamela Geller act that out here in New York City when she organized people first to get head of a school in Brooklyn fired, who happened to be an Arab woman, and then secondly, the Muslim Community Center they wanted to build about five blocks from Ground Zero, and they went after that too. I think you're absolutely right in characterizing her as a professional, you know, Muslim hater.
But not only me, but you have to realize what's so absurd about this is that these people slowly but surely have been exposed. But the Anti-Defamation League, of all people, did an expose on Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer and their hate group Stop Islamization of America, saying that they promote a conspiratorial anti-Muslim agenda under the guise of fighting radical Islam. Even Bridget Gabriel, she's the one who said that a practicing Muslim cannot be a loyal American. And even she was outed as a radical Islamophobe by the New York Times. But nonetheless, this group is so effective because it's so self-reliant, it's incestuous, and works so well together that they still nonetheless appear as quote-unquote legitimate voices on TV. For example, many of your listeners have seen Pamela Geller on mainstream Fox News. Why does she appear? I mean, would the Ku Klux Klan appear? Of course not. So this is why they really kind of have gone from fringe to mainstream, and that's also exposed in the network.
Again, we're speaking with Wajahat Ali, one of the authors of Fear, Inc., The Roots of Islamophobia Network in America. It's a completely brilliant report and well set out. Starts with the funders, then goes to the individuals, then goes to the groups, then goes to the results. Really clear, and I just want to just say this is a remarkable report to read. As we go on with this, can you just give a definition to our audience of Islamophobia?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking. Yes, we have really included a definition of Islamophobia in this report that I believe is apt and effective. And the definition that we have for Islamophobia is this following. Islamophobia is an exaggerated fear, hatred, and hostility towards Islam and Muslims that is perpetuated by negative stereotypes, resulting in bias, discrimination, and the marginalization and exclusion of Muslims from America's social, political, and civic life.
That's a great one. That's really an important definition. And it made me immediately think of how you talked about one of the key roots of Islamophobia. But, of course, the results we see in front of us all the time. I know the report isn't on that, but we can see what happens with the informants and prosecutions of Muslims in the country, the FBI going into mosques, particularly where I know you are on the West Coast, Southern California, and just how it comes out in not just in the media, but how then its results trickle down to your neighbor and who you rent the house to, the prosecutions, to all kinds of things.
Well, what happens is we can already see, unfortunately, how successful the Islamophobia network is. I mean, all you have to do is look at the manufactured, quote-unquote, Ground Zero Mosque controversy from the summer of 2010, which was, again, created by the network. It was a non-issue that over a period of the summer became transformed from a local issue to a national issue to an international hysteria. And, you know, the Ground Zero Mosque was first and foremost not a Ground Zero and not a mosque. When the people behind the community center came on Fox News in the spring of 2010, Laura Ingraham said, you know what, this is a good idea, and I think most Americans won't oppose it. Pamela Geller then runs with and calls it the Mega Mosque at Ground Zero. That meme gets repeated vis-a-vis the network, and all of a sudden you have Fox News again inviting all these people from the network who would then call the proposed Apartment 1 Community Center Mega Mosque at Ground Zero, an act of Islamic triumphalism. And then that gets pushed out to the hate radio. And next thing you know, it's an international hysteria, which inspires Pastor Jones, the fringe radical with the handlebar mustaches, who said he wants to burn the Quran. General Petraeus has to come in now and say, listen, please stop this extremist ideology and extremist rhetoric, because this emboldens our enemies in Afghanistan and Pakistan and threatens our troops. And April 2011, Pastor Jones goes ahead and burns the Quran, and the Taliban and uses this as a pretext to kill 20 civilians, United Nations civilians, saying, look, the West is at war with Islam. They burn the Quran. They protest our mosques. I mean, that's an example, really, of not only how this kind of increases an anti-Muslim sentiment and kind of marginalizes Muslims from participating in America, you know, the protests, the mosques, which are constitutionally protected houses of worship, but it also threatens our national security. And then the question goes, you know, why are we tolerating as a civil society, you know, Pamela Geller's and Frank Gaffney's and Robert Spencer's, and giving them the megaphone and giving them the microphone and really mainstreaming these fringe voices? When it comes to certain other extremist voices like Ku Klux Klan, we as a society realize that we have to expose them and marginalize them. We do not promote their agenda. And the thing is, you know, we're all for freedom of speech. We say, fine, have the belief that you want, have the ideas that you want, say what you want to say. But these people, as the network is exposed thoroughly in the report, you'll see that they have really moved beyond considered legitimate discourse into what is really extremist ideology that seeks to divide Americans along religious lines. And then this is up to us now. Now that they've been exposed, we as a society, I hope, says, you know what, enough's enough. This is not how we do business in America. This is what you guys did against Jews. This is what happened against Japanese Americans. This is what happened against Irish Catholic. And now the boogeyman is Muslim America. And this does nothing but poison the well. And we're going to marginalize you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, bravo for doing that. But I remember in the old days, there was an organization that was anti-Jewish. It was anti-Catholic. And it was, in a sense, a mainstream organization. Even had a Supreme Court Justice, Hugo Black, was a member of it. I'm talking about the Ku Klux Klan. And that organization didn't get put on the sidelines where it belongs until the civil rights struggle did it. My question to you, therefore, is what are you doing to publicize this report and struggling to get the truth out about the BS that these hate mongers are peddling?
You know, what we did, the report was always intended for a mainstream audience. I was asked about 6 months ago to kind of lead the research here, and I told them, I said, listen, if this is going to just exist in a D.C. cocoon, then we're not really doing our job. And Center for America Progress really understood that and said, you know what, that's exactly what we're going to do. We want to use this report to really empower Americans with information. This is a fact-based report. And the hope is that this information that is available in the report, which is written for a mainstream diverse audience, really kind of inoculates Americans, inoculates them from the fear, hysteria, and hate and misinformation that is spread by the network. So the next time they hear it, they go, you know what? You've been exposed. We know your agenda. We know your anti-Muslim agenda. We know that your agenda is actually anti-American. And what we've seen already is that this report within a week has gone viral. It's all over Facebook. It's all over Twitter. It's being, you know, slowly but surely it's moving horizontally across networks. And what we've seen also, it's moving vertically. And specifically, here's some good news, guys, that I can share with you. We haven't shared this with anyone else, really, and I was given permission to share this. Right before the report was released, Legal Department of Center for American Progress sent notices to the funders saying, hey, here's a heads up, what's your comment? We had 8 funders last week, and the report has 7. And that's because one of the funders read the report, found out we were about to release it, and they said, you know what, we had no idea that this is the agenda of the network. We had no idea that we were funding this. Please take our names off and rest assured that our $1.3 million will no longer go to the network. And voila, there was a stealth victory already. And the report really kind of did some positive damage last week.
How do our listeners get this report? Attorney Wajahat Ali, you were one of the co-authors of the report. How do people get a hold of it?
It's readily available online. The report's name is Fear Incorporated, Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. The Center for American Progress has put the entire report online, and we've really kind of broken it up in different sections, which makes it easily accessible. Again, it's entitled Fear Incorporated, Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. You can find it at the Center for American Progress's website. I really hope that not only do you read the report, but also spread it around to your communities.
It's an amazing report, Wajahat. Congratulations. And I agree with you. It's made really accessible. I went on the report yesterday, and it's laid out in clear language. There's graphs. There's pictures of the funding leading to individuals, leading to the foundations. It's really well done. It's a very important report. And congratulations again on stopping already one foundation. Let's hope the other 7 stop as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Exactly these types of shows where we can discuss this, so thanks so much.
Thanks for being on Law & Disorder.
All right, take care.
A key aspect of the surveillance state has been the attacks on Muslims. It's well known to all of us. They take many forms. They take the forms of the media, think tanks, and others labeling Muslims as dangerous, as subversive, as not American. They take the forms of the government prosecuting Muslims all over the country on trumped-up charges, using informants, on entrapments. The surveillance state, of course, has particulars that are aimed at the Muslim community in the United States and around the world. You could say the origin of the attacks on Muslims in the United States began with Bush's Crusader speech, made a few days after 9/11, in which he said the West was going to be engaged in a, quote, crusade to stop these, quote, terrorist attacks. Well, what is that about except Christians against Muslims? And that has characterized the core of much of American actions in this country. It's aimed at Muslims. It's aimed at Muslims on the street. It's aimed at them in terms of who they prosecute. It's aimed at who they surveil, having FBI agents go to every single mosque in the country, knocking on Muslims' doors. It's aimed by the media and think tanks to try and characterize Muslims as un-American. All of the junk you hear about the implications of Sharia law coming to the United States, all of that is part of really what has to be placed directly on President Bush's shoulders, the crusade against the Muslim world. It has its implications. Muslims are now a persecuted, very persecuted minority in the United States. Let's now hear some of the voices of the Muslim persecutions in the United States.
What is your religion? What mosque do you attend? How often do you pray? Now, these types of questions have nothing to do with criminal activity. It's really a harassment of these law-abiding Americans, and it creates a chilling effect on their First Amendment rights and their activities.
And that's really the key part of it, that when there aren't guidelines governing when and who the FBI should investigate, they tend to stray from people who we want them investigating. We want them investigating people who are engaged in wrongdoing.
It seems to me this is like a giant racist distraction.
Well, this is legal religious bigotry that unfortunately continues to happen.
And what we have found particularly disturbing is that this questioning goes into First Amendment protected speech, beliefs.
I believe that there is a systemic problem with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Individual agents whom I have had the painful privilege to talk to and interact with more in the past, I don't know, between 2001 and 2005, and since thereafter I don't speak to them, but during those conversations, they used to share that this is grandly stupid. They are just keeping us busy on doing things that has nothing to do with actual intelligence gathering.
And now, even though it's almost 10 years after 9/11, we're seeing it not get better, but get worse.
Right.
How do you see your work, and where do we go from here? I mean, it's incredible to me, coming out of the 70s and then out of, you know, the huge investigation against Central America people, which we exposed in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
And to see it even under Obama go so far downhill. I can't imagine what your work is like, but just what are you doing now to figure this out?
It's very frustrating because so much of what's happening is happening in secret. And you know, I thought it was really quite poignant when Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, during the Patriot Act debate, the reauthorization debate just a couple weeks ago, came to the Senate floor, and he has the advantage of sitting on the Senate Intelligence Committee, so he gets to see at least as much as any congressman gets to see as to what the FBI is doing. And he came to the floor and you know, warned his colleagues, and he said, you know, the government has a secret interpretation of this law.
It can be called entrapment, because what you have is people who have not committed a crime, who are targeted by the FBI, visited by the FBI, usually undercover agents. And in many cases, the people they use aren't even agents. They're informants that the FBI hired, paid government informants, some of them with criminal pasts, who are oftentimes from the same community. So in the cases I looked at, it's a Pakistani immigrant and an Egyptian immigrant who are in trouble with the law for different reasons. They are offered large sums of money and offered, in some cases, a plea deal for whatever crime they might have committed if they agree to work for the FBI.
What we know for a fact in Southern California, through ongoing surveillance of mosques, through the infiltration of provocateurs and predators in mosques, surveilling the sermons, surveilling the activities, attempts to recruit mosque members to keep an eye out on the clergy leader, the imams, and the mosque activities, approaching and intimidating and harassing students to recruit them to spy on the clergy leaders and the lay leaders of the mosques and reporting the activities. Folks coming back from travel, being stopped at the airport, again asking the similar questions: which mosque do you go to, what activities takes place in the mosques, and so on and so forth.
You know, many of you probably don't understand how the government is interpreting the law and the types of activities that they're engaged in, and collection activities that they're engaged in. And when the American public finds out, they're going to be very shocked and angry.
And the cases you looked at, Anjali, why don't you just mention those, the names of those cases, and a couple of sentences about them?
Absolutely. So there were three cases that I looked at, and I mean, these are three out of dozens of cases. The first case is the case that took place in Albany in 2004, which involves a Bangladeshi pizza owner and a Kurdish imam of a mosque. And both of them were convicted. They are now serving prison time. Their sentence was reduced from 30 years to 15 years because the case was very thin and there was an outpouring of community support.
But the people that particularly that were targeted here were very vulnerable people. These were people that had become somewhat exposed to Islam in prison, but did not know much about the religion. They were not, in some cases, practicing Muslims. They had other problems, like one of them had a crack cocaine problem. Another one had mental problems, very serious mental problems, actually. Another one was homeless for a while. These are people that were very susceptible to money offers and to the certain grandiosity that all of this was offered to them. You could have gone to almost any part of a city, upstate New York, and found people that would have been willing to grab at a deal like this. It was money, a lot of money, for potentially very little activity.
In any case, this individual calls, and I get his phone number, and I call this FBI agent, who I don't know. He's a rookie, I guess. And I called him on his behalf and said, what are you trying to meet this gentleman for? Of course, he was quite shocked and surprised to receive a call from me than from him. My conversation with him simply revealed he is simply revisiting the files that were left behind by his predecessor or whoever handed over those files to him. So he's simply reopening those files because the files exist on community leaders. And when a new guy takes charge of a particular area or section or a geographic jurisdiction, then they revisit all of that again. And I said, I'll be more than happy to meet with you. You need to come to my office and I'll have an attorney present. And at 99.9% of the time, it never happens. They never call you back.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now, you should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law & Disorder to your friends through Facebook.